This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Rhiannon Giddens has had one of the more unusual career paths of any musician I know of. She studied opera, training to be a soprano at one of the most prestigious music programs in the country. But almost by chance, she fell hard and deep into the study of American folk music. She became the frontwoman of a string band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops, focusing on reviving forgotten musical traditions of the Black diaspora. And they received a Grammy Award 10 years ago.
While he was scheming, I was beaming, and his beamer just beaming. Can't believe that I caught my man cheating. So I found another way to make him pay for it all.
As a solo artist, though, she's moved increasingly far afield. I spoke with her after her album There Is No Other came out in 2019. She was exploring folk styles from the Middle East and Europe as well as early America in collaboration with the musician Francesco Tarisi. She's nominated for a Grammy for another album with Tarisi called They're Calling Me Home.
Can I have your C? Isn't and the banjo tuned to the accordion the beginning of a joke? Some sort.
When we spoke, they started off by playing Wayfaring Stranger, a traditional song dating to the 19th century.
I'm going home.
Brianne and Francesco, that was magnificent. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Brianne, I have to tell you that I think it was 6 years ago already.
Oh my gosh.
That there was this amazing night at Town Hall in New York that was put on as a kind of promotion and concert for Inside Llewellyn Davis, which was about the folk scene of the late 50s and 60s. And it was a pretty good lineup. It was
You're
a pretty
me.
Good lineup. Joan Baez, so many people. And you got up and brought the house down and brought the house to its feet. Tell me about that night, what you sang and what that was like, killing like that.
Well, it was a really interesting experience because when T-Bone asked me to do it, you know.
It's T-Bone Burnett, who produced the album and all the music for the film.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't done a lot of solo stuff at that point because I'd just really been doing the Chocolate Drops and, you know, it was not with my band. It was, you know, it was all very instinctual. I was just like, I just wanted to not screw up. I don't know. I was kind of so shocked by the response to it, you know, that the following days, the write-ups, I had no idea it was such a big deal. It was literally like ghosting the song and don't screw it up. You know, and
did it change your career? Did it change your life in any way that night?
It did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's how my next two collaborations were with T-Bone, and that they totally came out of that night. My solo record, Tomorrow's My Turn. I had no intention of going solo anytime, you know, soon. I was like really focused on the Chocolate Drops and was very excited about it. And then it was kind of like, well, you know, and T-Bone Burnett says, let's do a solo record. You don't go, can you come back in a couple years? You just go, yes, you know.
Now, your records are often categorized as something called Americana, which is a term that you hear a lot, and it gets stuck on folk music, all various kinds of music. Do you embrace it? Do you reject it? And what does it mean to you?
I have a complicated relationship with Americana as a term. I have a complicated relationship with genres. I hate them, number one.
You just want it to be called music.
I just want it to be called music, or even American music's fine. You know, acoustic music. Now, Americana, I understand what they're trying to do, you know, commercial country kind of has gone down this certain road, and they're trying to create a space for the singer-songwriter for the story song. You know, I get all that. I still feel like, you know, you make a genre, you tend to narrow into it.
Now, you're on your third solo album, and you've got a new collaborator who's sitting here with us, Francesco Tirisi. Tell me about your musical relationship and how this came to become an album.
Well, yeah, I guess it's kind of, it was just one of those kind of magical things. Do you want to say how?
I got in touch first with Rhiannon about 4 years ago. I knew about the Carolina Chocolate Drops and I'd heard some of the music. I was doing a lot of research at the time in the early history of jazz, and I thought it was a very interesting take.
Scholarly research.
Well, I was lecturing history of jazz. I mean, we're both kind of musicians who have a lot of interest in research, so I don't know if I would call myself a scholar, but we read a lot of books, put it that way. So I just thought it was a very interesting missing link that nobody talks about, the Black String Band in the history of early jazz. And
well, tell us about that. What is the missing link, and describe what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about this, but the way I saw it was just that, you know, because I was actually teaching history of jazz in a BA course in Dublin, which is where I live. We both live in Ireland. And just reading all the classic literature on the early history of jazz, everybody focuses very much on the brass bands and the importance of that kind of in New Orleans and the development of early jazz. And the string bands are never really mentioned in that transition between ragtime and early jazz. And they were obviously a big part of it all. Maybe you should say something about that, because that's your corner.
Fill us in. What are we ignoring? What are we missing?
Well, the string band and the black string band in particular, you know, it really is at the heart of so many. Here we go with genres again, the genres of American music. And it was a widespread phenomenon, you know, that goes back to the time of slavery when black people were seen as natural musicians. They were encouraged to pick up instruments and then play for white people's dances and frolics and parties. And so you have the combination of, you know, native rhythms and modes from West Africa, from all over where people were coming from, and instruments that were coming over, like the banjo, which grew out of West African lute-type instruments. I mean,
how much of this do we have recorded?
It's huge. Not any. That's the problem.
So how are you excavating the music in a way?
With dots. You know, with the sheet music.
That must give you a very wide berth on how to play it.
Well, the thing is like there's a lot of scholarship that's been done on these early banjo tutors. They were very, very clear on how to play this instrument. And
you keep saying this instrument. We have one on the floor
here. Sorry.
Can you describe what this is? Because it's obviously not the kind of thing that you'd see Earl Scruggs play or.
Yeah, the banjo that I have is a replica of, well, it's kind of a composite of some banjos from the late 1850s. It's a wooden banjo. See, the early minstrel style banjos were all fretless. People are always surprised by this because it's fretless and they were gut string. And that's because they were that one step removed from the homemade gourd instruments that black folk would have been making on plantations or wherever. And that was the banjo first. And so they were all be playing these kind of instruments, which are wooden hoop, wooden fretboard, fretless, and it's just a deeper, more resonant sort of round, warm sound.
And Francesca, you're playing a drum that is called a
duff.
A duff.
It's a drum that comes from Iran. It's a large frame drum that has got a particularity that has got little iron rings hanging. And they could kind of, by shaking the drum, you hit the skin and they create a really washy type of sound.
Give it a little. So these many dozens of rings that are on the inside lip of the drum, that's what makes that kind of haunted
sound. Yeah, so it's a drum that you find in Iran and in other countries in Central Asia, used in folk music, but it's also an instrument used by Sufi brotherhoods, and they use it for trance dancing, you know? So this kind of washy sound very often you find in cultures related to trance, you know?
And what you're going to play, is, I understand, is a kind of ghost story in a song called Little Margaret.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
That was actually one of the earliest things that we connected on, this idea of the drum, the frame drum in across the ocean, Middle East and in North Africa and the Mediterranean being a drum that's supposed to be played with a singer. You know, because it's got a tone to it. And so we were looking for that connection. And I thought, well, Appalachian ballads, like they also have that trance feel as well. And so it just worked so beautifully. Little Margaret is I learned from Sheila K. Adams from Western North Carolina. And it goes all the way back to, you know, some English ballad from centuries ago.
We don't know who wrote it.
It's old. It's really old, like 14th century. I mean, it's like old. It goes back. But this is an Appalachian version. And it's basically the story of a young woman who was in love with a man. And he goes out, starts, you know, seeing somebody else. Later that night, she appears to him at his bedside. and he sees her and realizes that it's her that he wants. And so he goes to visit her, and then he finds out that she's died. And in the song, the imagery is basically that her appearing in white means that she's a ghost, even though he doesn't realize that. And then when he goes to her father's and she's in her cold black coffin with her face turned toward the wall, that was her face turned toward the wall meant that she was a suicide. And then at the end, when he falls into her arms, that means he dies. Like, so these are all kind of imagery that were used in lots of different ballads to sort of denote these things without actually coming out and saying them.
Spooky stuff.
Spooky stuff, yeah.
So I'd love to hear it.
Well, let's do it.
Little Margaret sitting in her high-hole chair, combing back her long yellow hair, saw sweet William and his new maid bride riding up the road so near. She threw down her ivory comb, threw back her long yellow hair, said, I'll go down and I'll bid him farewell and I'll never more go there. It was late in the night, they were fast asleep. Little Margaret appeared all dressed in white, standing at their bed feet, saying, how do you like your snow white pillow? How do you like your sheep? Saying, how do you like that pretty fair maid who lays in your arms asleep? Very well do I like my snow white pillow. Well do I like my sheep. Much better do I like that pretty fair maid who stands at my bed feet. He called a serving man to go saddle the dappled roan, and he rode for her father's house that night, knocked on the door alone, saying, is little Margaret in her room, or is she in the hall? Little Margaret's in her coal black coffin with a face turned toward the wall. Unfold, unfold those snow white robes, be they ever so fine, for I want to kiss those cold, cold lips, for I know they'll never kiss mine. Three times he kissed her cold, cold hand, twice he kissed her cheek, and once he kissed her cold, cold lips, and he fell in her arms. Asleep.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. And you, what, how much of this song was given to you and how much of it is yours in terms of its invention or melody?
I mean, that's, you know, it was originally an Appalachian ballad, like unaccompanied. So it's, I'm singing it just like that. What I'm doing is when we first started playing it, I just sort of, instead of just going through the song, you know, with no pauses in between the lines, there were moments where the drum kind of, I would slow the action down a little bit, and then when it speeds up again, so that definitely came from me just kind of reacting to what he was playing, you know.
Rhiannon Giddens. I spoke with her in 2019, and our conversation continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm speaking today with the musician Rhiannon Giddens, who was just nominated for 2 Grammys, Best Folk Album and Best American Roots Song. Giddens and I talked in 2019 when her album, There Is No Other, was just out, in collaboration with Francesco Turisi. We'll continue now. Rhiannon, you went to Oberlin. You studied. You had formal training there.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of opera. Opera. Mm-hmm. How did you become you? How did you kind of create yourself and your sense of direction and where you would go in music, coming out of a place like Oberlin where you had had this formal training?
Did you
think you were going to be singing Les Somnambules or being an opera singer?
We all do, coming out of conservatory.
Right.
We're going to be the next big soprano, you know?
What happened?
I discovered folk music, and I discovered the banjo, and I also, you know, I'm very interested in doing something that is A, of service, and B, that not everybody else is doing. So I was like, gosh, there's like a million sopranos in the world who can sing as good or much better than I can,
yeah,
who can do these things and want to devote their life to opera, where I'm seeing this other thing and I'm like, this is something I think I can make a difference in, you know? And it touches me and it speaks to me. And so it for me, it goes to show that you have to find the thing that you are meant to do, you know, and you don't know what it is always, but if you follow the thing that's speaking to you, you just don't know where it's going to lead you.
Well,
you know?
I hate to pound on this notion of categories, but what you just sang, is that classical music in a sense?
No. I mean, but then what, I mean...
That's what I mean.
You know, what is classical music, you know? I mean, we do on the album 2 arias, you know, but we do them in vernacular voice and with a sort of improv accompaniment, and it's like, they live in a different realm and they touch people in a different way, but they're, you know, does it still mean that they're not an aria anymore? I mean, you know, I mean, that's kind of also the point of the record is, you know, who cares what the, and it, this is not just smashing stuff together. Like, that's important to mention. It's not like, you know, I mention our similar approaches because I think that's why our layers kind of work, you know, because we're layering things on top of each other and finding where the peaks, because there's all of these similarities between all of these different things, and
right,
and it leads us to, you know, what music is doing for us as humanity, you know, because somebody was saying, well, you know, our diversity is also our strength. You're saying that we're all the same. I'm like, well, in our differences, we're the same.
Yeah.
That's the point, is that, you know, we express ourselves in different ways, but it's all coming back to these universal truths as humans, and the more that we can reject that idea that you are over there and you sound different to me, so that we're different people, and embrace that actually what I do in my culture and what you do in your culture is coming from the same heart, and therefore they should be able to work together. You know, that's more of what we're trying to say.
How does that relate to the next song that I think you're going to do? And you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation to get it exactly right.
Yes.
Pizzica di San Vito.
That's pretty good.
And means?
Pizzica is a type of dance from Puglia, which is an Apulian region, mm-hmm. you know. So it's a type of tarantella, which is a very lively, I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of that. But the particular thing about this music that a lot of people don't know about is that it was music to cure the bite of a spider. And it was, no, this is a very serious thing, actually. The idea with the pizzica is that you got bitten. They believed in the bite of the spider, tarantula, that's why it's called tarantella. And you would fall into a state of depression. And the only way to get rid of this was to trance dance, which could go on sometimes for weeks. You know, the musicians would come to your house.
So it's pre-antibiotics.
Definitely pre-antibiotic. Mind you, this was the last time observed in its full power in the 1960s. 1960s was still happening in Puglia.
Incredible. How is that tuned? How is it tuned?
See, well, right now it's in modal. But I have like three different tunings I use.
Non c'è da venire, non c'è da venire, non c'è da venire, sono venuto. Solisse spirito, solisse spirito, m'hanno chiamato. Aueli, mulo vecchio ti veni, mulo vecchio tinchinami dalla mano si ne va. Aueli, mulo vecchio ti veni, mulo vecchio tinchinami dalla mano si ne va. Ti li capelli tu, ti li capelli, ti li capelli tu, tu innamorato. Li vecchio ti volà, li vecchio ti volà, li vecchio ti volà, talo vientu. Occhi co deci perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori. Occhi co deci perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori.
Think of as your audience for music like this, or do you not think of it? Is it not worth thinking about?
I mean, you just can't. You can't think about audiences. You know, you just. I mean, that's.
Who do you see in the seats?
Well, I mean, it depends on where we are. I mean, we haven't actually really started touring this yet, but you know, it depends on who knows about it. I mean, this is the sort of push me pull you of being a professional musician is that if they don't hear about it, they're not going to come. You know, like, I mean, part of my mission has been trying to get the music that I play to more of the black community, for example, which is what people always ask me. So why are there only white people at your shows? Number one, there aren't only white people at my shows. There are always people of color who come. It's just a very small percentage of the overall whole. And the other thing is that the gatekeepers of like black culture are not interested in what I'm doing, you know, and this is a complaint I've heard from many, many people of color who do music that's not considered black. That's not, you know,
what does that mean? What is considered black now, and who are the gatekeepers that we're talking about?
Like, you know, like hip-hop, R&B, blues, you know, well, blues, I mean, people know it's black, but like, you know, and there's black people who play it, but it's become...
It's a largely white audience.
You know, white sure. audience and white players, yeah. you know, as well. And jazz is one of those, it's kind of like, you know, in that kind of halfway house world, you know, and then opera. You know, there's like been, you know, there's been black people singing opera and doing writing classical music forever, you know, and it's like we're seen as sort of interlopers, and so it's very hard. I've talked to other people who have the same thing. I mean, I was talking to Tavis Smiley. I was on his show because Freedom Highway. I started that tour at Sing Sing Prison, and it was the largest black audience I've ever had, and that just like broke me in several pieces.
What was that like? Know? Tell me about that concert.
I mean, it was very intense, you know, to get like a cultural response that I'm not used to. Because
this is at Sing Sing Prison in Austin, New York.
Yeah,
just north of the city.
With the Carnegie Fountain, you know, the Carnegie Hall does this amazing program going right. in. And we worked with one of the prisoners on one of his songs about domestic violence. I mean, it was really intense. They were beautiful. And you just kind of...
So it wasn't just a performance. You were there for a while.
We did work. Yeah, we were there the whole day, you know. Mm-hmm. And you just look out that sea of brown faces and you know, and you think about what does that mean for, you know, when you talk about the incarceration of black men and men of color and, you know, how the broken the system is. But then from a purely performance point of view, I was just like, the way that they responded to the music was different than when I have, you know,
how so?
I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, like, just the energy that was given back. And I didn't know the personal stories of any of them. Didn't want to know, because it's just like, that wasn't the purpose of the visit, you know?
What did you play for them?
We played a full concert. I brought my full band, and we played a lot of stuff from Freedom Highway. And so it's just like I feel very strongly, like I'm starting to work with my nephew, who's a 21-year-old rapper who plays the banjo. Right. I taught.
That's an unusual combination.
It is an unusual combination. And he, you know, he's a heavy rapper. Like, this is, he knows hip hop. He knows that world. And this is the way he chooses to express himself.
You're going to record with him?
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to record.
What's his name?
His name's Justin Harrington. Amazing. Demeanor is his handle. But it's just like when you start crossing over into that generation and he's like, man, when I'm playing this stuff for my friends, they're like, what is that? That's amazing. And I'm like, exactly. It's like when people are exposed to this stuff, they're like, that's so cool. But getting there is the hurdle.
Rhiannon and Francesco, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Rhiannon Giddens and her collaborator, Francesco Terisi. I spoke with them in 2019, and they're nominated for 2 Grammys for the album They're Calling Me Home. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
On a night in May 2010, some $70 million of art were stolen from a museum in Paris in one night. For months, the French police couldn't find the thief, and they still haven't found the paintings. Who pulls off something like this, and how? Here's contributor Jake Halpern with the story of the thief known as the Spider-Man of Paris.
It was the screw that gave it away. Viren Tomic was standing in the dark at night in front of a window of the MAM in Paris. That's the Museum of Modern Art. He just used his pocket knife to scrape the paint away so that he could see the screw better, examine just how it bit into the window frame. And it confirmed his hunch. The frame was old-fashioned, just like the window from a job he'd done before. He knew how to take it apart. A few days later, Tomic goes back to the MAM. The galleries are open, and like everyone else, he goes into the front door, buys a ticket, and wanders around. On the walls, there are Picassos, Kandinskys, and some motion detectors that don't seem to be working. He makes a note. The sensors, the paintings, the windows. There's an opportunity here. Tomic has been writing to me for a year from his jail cell in France. An actor is reading from the letters that he wrote to me.
I was a child with a devious tendency, an evil disposition. I did not speak much. I remember myself when I was 7 or 8 years old, and cousins I lived with. I would put cactus spines in their shoes to see how much pain they could stand. I locked a friend my age in an empty barrel. We were playing hide-and-seek. I abandoned him, hoping that nobody would find him.
The press calls him Spider-Man, but he says that's been his nickname since he was a kid, back when he grew up in a Bosnian mountain town, famous for its raging river and tall bridge. Local kids made a sport of climbing the rocks along the riverbank and leaping into the water.
It's a custom for us, like in Acapulco in Mexico. For me, climbing started around the age of 6 or 7.
That's where Tomich climbed to his first robbery. He used a ladder to get to the window of a library about 16 feet up a wall. He stole a few old books. When he was 11, Tomich left Bosnia-Herzegovina for Paris. His family lived in a building that shared a wall with the Père Lachaise Cemetery, where Jim Morrison, Marcel Proust, Edith Piaf, and many others are buried.
There was everything in the cemetery. Black masses at night, hippies going to Jim Morrison's grave. Hundreds of people came on pilgrimage. There were drugs everywhere, and dealer gangs would fight each other. It was our playground because it was the only thing we had. The cemetery in front of the window.
Tomich had a hard time in Paris, a hard time learning French, and money was tight for the family. His mother was disabled, and his father was mean to him, cold. Tomich often ran away from home. By 12, he started stealing things to get by. He'd break into cars and steal the stereos or rummage around in the glove box. By 14, he and some friends had started breaking into apartments.
My first burglary in Paris. I used the cemetery outer wall to access the yard and climb one of the buildings. I got a gold-plated Dupont lighter with a small bag of jewels and no more than 150 francs. So, did I imagine that I was going to become a famous burglar? Of course.
He got hooked.
It started as a test, like an obsession to do something more. Something was pulling me, encouraging me to do it. Later, I found that there was a double personality in me, a spiritual guide. My ability to sneak into buildings is like a gift. I sometimes think for a while. Then, as if by magic, without the magic wand, I have the formula.
The night after he uncovers the screw in the MAM window, Tomich goes back. He wears a hoodie, and he walks around the outside of the museum very carefully. He has to pick the right window. And there's one just behind a parapet, out of view of the security cameras.
The one on the corner of the façade that allowed me to watch over both sides of the esplanade. Nobody could see me, except for a few passing cars.
Now the museum, it's across the street from the Seine. Tomich finds an inconspicuous spot to sit, and he waits.
I stay there 5 hours to see if an internal or external security check will happen. Inside, a guard shows up around 3 o'clock in the morning. A guard with a dog comes to the street to check the surroundings. So, I am not alone. The museum is not alone.
He watches for another night, just to make sure that he's got the guard's routine down. And once he figures out his window and the schedule, Tomich goes back with supplies. He's got a dark piece of cloth that he hangs like a curtain outside the window to give himself cover.
It is smart, and it allows me to do my job quietly, without being seen.
Tomich sits and works. He uses paint-stripping acid to expose the heads of each screw. Then he applies another solution to remove the rust.
I chose acid with a stripper for the frame paint, a small Dremel tool to remove the plaster where the screws are. It is necessary to sand off and clean everything. 2 hours per night, 6 nights. There is a lot of work to be done.
And always, always, he keeps an eye on his watch. He's a pro. He's been doing this for decades. He's come to believe that his success is part practice, but also part destiny. It's like he feels mystically drawn to the places he robs.
I also have to be in harmony with certain places. Some places pull me. something is waiting for me. Sometimes it's hard to understand what I feel. So I let myself be guided by my subconscious. The luxury apartment started when I was 17 years old.
His first one is this chic building, and he gets his way up onto the roof and then rappels down the side to the fourth floor to the apartment that he's got his eye on.
The apartment was more than 5,000 square feet. I noticed white sheets on some dressers and furniture. All the works of art were placed on the wooden floor. There were lots of them. It looked like a museum.
Tomich didn't know anything about paintings, and so it didn't occur to him to take them. But he did notice a catalog for an upcoming art auction. And a few weeks later, he went to check it out.
That's when I realized that a month before I had at my feet everything that was in front of me at the auction. There were two Renoir and several Ingres and Degas. When I realized the prices, I couldn't believe it. The famous books of Picasso and Chagall were sold for more than 800,000 francs at the time. That's how I came to like works of art, because everything that was sold was worth millions.
But here's the thing. Stealing art, it's not the same as selling art. Stolen masterpieces are like gold that happens to be radioactive. They seem valuable, but are actually dangerous and unsellable.
Jewels were the best choice. I could live off them and never be in jail. Really, I got into art personally. I like paintings the most. I had Degas, Renoir, Signac, Derain, Pissarro, Dubuffet, and many others. To sell them was dangerous, and I never had reliable sources abroad to flog them to collectors or receivers.
Tomich got caught sometimes. In fact, he spent nearly 15 years in prison. There was one guy, though, who Tomich could sell to reliably. His name was Jean-Michel Corvez, and he ran this small gallery right in the Bastille. Corvez was a middleman, so he had clients, and they had particular tastes. And those tastes were the basis of a kind of shopping list that he gave to Tomich. On this list, there was Basquiat, Chagall, Klimt, Pizarro, Monet. Oh, and Modigliani and Leger, they were on the list too. And they were also on the walls of the MAM when Tomich strolled through the museum. So after he spots these paintings, Tomich meets with Corvez. He tells him what he's seen, and Corvez says that he wants the Leger, a painting called Still Life with Candlestick. They haggled. Corvez would only pay 40,000 euros, which was less than Tomich wanted, and way less than the painting was worth. But in the end, Tomich gave in. The money was nice, of course. But for Tomich, he also just loved pulling off a clean heist. It's the early hours of May 20th. The streets are quiet. It's dark. Paris is asleep. And Tomich's window is ready. He's bought two suction cups that he attaches to the glass pane. And then he uses a crowbar to ever so gently pry the window from the frame.
There is also the seismic sound alarm on each. The slightest noise can trigger it. So I am very careful, especially when I move the window pane, which is very heavy. Behind the window pane, there is the grill, padlocked with a chain, which I have to open. It is not hard.
He slips into the museum and then leaves almost immediately. He goes back to the banks of the Seine, where he waits for 15 full minutes just to make sure no alarms have gone off in the museum. When it seems like the coast is clear, he climbs back through the window a second time. He takes the Leger off the wall and out of its frame. Now, this should be it. Mission accomplished. A clean job. But standing alone in the museum, in the dim light and the silence, a feeling overtakes him. That old irresistible pull. And he finds himself staring face to face with Matisse's pastoral of three nudes reclining in a verdant setting, while a fourth figure with dark red coloring plays a lute.
It's magical. Its colors and the paint that pops out a little in relief, thick, make a beautiful work. In this painting, I saw a deep, vivid nature, much more fertile than today. And the little devil playing his flute out of nowhere, as if by magic, as if he were the guardian of this environment where hostesses' guests join in on his alluring music. I love impressionists.
He grabs it, and a Modigliani, and then three more paintings. Then he spots another. It's Modigliani's Woman with Blue Eyes.
I will never forget what this woman with blue eyes did to me. When I went to get it off the wall, it told me, "If you take me, you will regret it for the rest of your life." I think when I touched it, to take it out of its frame, it started instantly. A fear that came over me, like an iceberg. A freezing fear. All the hair of my arms were stiff. I had to run away. That was it.
So he leaves the painting on the wall. He takes the others out of their frames and carries them to his car. And he sits there for 5 minutes, equivocating. I mean, he's so close to the museum, he could go back for more. The window, it's still accessible. It would be so easy. And like that, he's in motion again, crossing the street back towards the museum that he's just robbed. He's stepping over a small barrier when his pants rip. A car stops at a red light a few hundred feet away, and boom, reality sets in. The streets are empty, and here he is, next to the museum, wearing a hooded sweatshirt, looking very much like the thief that he is. He leaves, this time for good.
The evening at MAM could have been worse. Not for me, but for them. 5 was the limit. I saw the burglary of the 5 paintings from the MAM in my dreams, 15 years earlier. I knew that someday I would do something great.
More than $70 million worth of art stolen in one night. The 5 paintings were some of the most important in the museum's collection. Investigators said that the thief had a sophisticated knowledge of the works. At least, he had a good eye. The next morning, though, Tomich has a problem. Instead of one stolen painting on his hands, he has 5. When he meets the buyer, Corvez, he only gets paid for the Leger, the painting they'd agreed on. A shoebox filled with 40,000 euros in small bills. But Tomich gives all 5 paintings to Corvez. Corvez says he'll try to sell 3, no promises, but Tomich wants Matisse's Pastoral for himself. He's just leery of having it on him right now. After all, he's a convicted art thief. He's got to lay low. Sure enough, the police start watching him. As their investigation points ever towards Tomich, they begin listening in on some of his phone calls. And when they actually call his phone, they get this surreal greeting.
If you want to buy paintings or works of art or exceptional jewelry, do not hesitate to contact me. Among the lot of paintings, there are also 5 that are extremely expensive. So we can discuss.
Tomich is so eager to sell the other paintings that he's actually advertising them to people who call. And he's bragging a bit, too. But the police, they need more than just an outrageous phone message to arrest Tomich. They need material evidence. About a year goes by, and Tomich needs money. But it's not just money he needs. He wants his Matisse back from Corvez. On the upside, you know, he's not in jail. And maybe even the MAM robbery will go unsolved, and he'll eventually get some money for the rest of the MAM paintings that he'd given to Corvez. But Tomich robs this other apartment, and he gets busted. This time he stole some watches and a Pizarro, and when the police search Tomich's apartment, they find the stolen jewelry, bunch of watches, climbing equipment. They also found paintings, but not the ones from the MAM. When the police questioned him, Tomich confessed to the latest apartment robbery. But then the police tell him that just a couple of days earlier, they'd questioned Jean-Michel Corvez too, and Tomich, he gets paranoid.
I could not believe it. Maybe he wanted me to go to jail, so he walks away. With people like Corvez, you will quickly rot in a very deep hole for the rest of your life.
He's totally worried that Corvez is going to pin the entire MAM job on him. Lie about the fact that it was Corvez himself who commissioned the robbery in the first place. Not just that. What if Corvez would get off and keep the paintings? Or worse yet, what if he'd already sold them without giving Tomich any money?
I had been waiting for a year, I thought. He had already sold all my works. It was a nightmare. The question is to know where the works really are right now.
Now, if Tomich confessed to his part and told them everything he knew about Corvez, maybe at least the police would find the art.
For me, the trial was the solution to make the paintings reappear. Maybe they are still alive, but well hidden.
At trial, Corvez said he'd pass them along to someone else, another middleman, who then testified that he'd panicked and thrown them into the trash. Yeah, the trash. In France, there's no penalty for lying on the stand. And Tomich doesn't believe that Corvez or the middleman told the truth. And I gotta wonder how honest Tomich was with me. He seemed to really love telling his story, but sometimes I felt like he was toying with me, just reveling in the mystery that he had in fact created. And sometimes he seems to think that whoever has the paintings will give them up.
One day or another, he will be forced to give them to the person to whom they belong. That is to say, me.
The letters of Vierre and Tomich were read for us by the actor Jean Brassard. Jake Halperin's most recent book is Welcome to the New World. It's based on his Pulitzer Prize-winning story about a Syrian refugee family. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.